Hello and welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Bill Shorten recently had a minor reshuffle of his front bench, and it saw Katie Gallagher, former ACT Chief Minister, elevated to Shadow Minister for Mental Health, as well as spokesperson on housing and homelessness. She's also assisting the leader on federal state matters. It's been a quick rise for the former ACT politician. She's only just arrived in the Senate this year, but it's not an unexpected rise given her experience. Katie Gallagher, how have you found the transition from ACT Chief Minister to Federal Senator? It's a very different scene, although, of course, you had long experience as a politician.
Hi, Michelle. And yeah, look, I found it actually a bit harder than I thought I would. I thought I'd transition seamlessly from politics to politics, from state or territory politics to national politics, and it's been a much bigger learning curve for me than I'd thought, and a very different role. I've gone from being a very hands-on, operational person involved in a lot of day-to-day problem-solving and media, to having to relearn a role within a much bigger team with a much different, very different job in the Senate.
What do you think's been the most difficult thing about the move?
Well, I think for me it's been learning my place in a bigger team. I've gone from being in charge of the parliamentary team and really being the chief director in the ACT Assembly, being in control of the parliamentary agenda, the political agenda, being the person that everybody came to with questions, to just a member of an 80-strong team.
So is this from big fish to middle-sized fish problem, or something more than that?
Oh no, more than that. In the sense of I don't have any problem with that. It was more learning, you know, what is my role within this much bigger team, and also understanding my role within, I guess, a much faster, harder and meaner political system.
Well, just talking about that, the House of Reps is obviously very fast and mean, but the Senate is usually considered to be a bit more civilised, a bit slower, a bit less the House of Insults. How do you compare it to the ACT Parliament?
There are a lot of similarities, actually, the Senate with the ACT Parliament. It's the smaller chamber, obviously. It's quite an intimate chamber. So actually on the floor, I think you do find different behaviour to what you see in the House of Representatives. The committee system is very similar, where you have members of different political parties sitting on committees having to deliver reports and actually work together. So there are quite a number of similarities. I think the difference for me is, whilst it's quite civilised most of the time, when there is an issue underway, whether it be a leadership change, which we've seen, or some other campaign that's being waged, the battle lines are drawn pretty quickly and they're pretty firm.
And things can move quite rapidly in terms of votes. And
exactly.
You don't want to get caught in the wrong part of the building or outside the building in a crucial vote, I guess. Now, you're assisting Bill Shorten on state and territory relations. How is it to see this process from the other side of the divide, having been Territory Chief Minister?
So this is a new role that Bill has prioritised, and I think one of the reasons he wanted me to do this was that I could bring that perspective of being a state territory leader to some of the discussions and the policy formulation. I think, certainly sitting at the COAG table, I've seen how Commonwealth governments of all political persuasions tend to treat the states and territories, and it is very much almost like a parent-child relationship where you get punished or rewarded based on your particular position. And I think, you know, I'll be able to bring, if an idea is being proposed, I'll certainly be able to see it from the view of the states and territories, and
so
perhaps
sympathies are still a bit with the children.
Well, look, I understand where they are coming from, and whether I guess I'll bring a perspective about whether I think concerns or ideas are legitimate and deserve further either consideration or endorsement. But, you know, I think that certainly Bill is very well versed in how the Commonwealth thinks, as are a number of other of the colleagues in Shadow Cabinet. But I will be bringing, I guess, a different perspective coming from working for 10 years or more at this territory level.
Let's just turn to mental health. I note that you've been pretty critical of how the system is working at the moment and the government's alleged neglect of it and so on. But currently, $14 billion is spent on mental health annually. Both sides of government, I think, in recent years have put a lot of money into this area. Why hasn't more been achieved?
Well, I think that's the question that remains largely unanswered. I mean, we've just had a review that was finalised last year that probably provides us with the best snapshot we can have currently on the state of the mental health system. I think part of it is around coordination of services and how the Commonwealth and states and territories fund services. There's crossover, there is duplication, there is an alignment between priorities across government, and I think at the end of the day it's the individual with a mental illness or the carers that suffer from that. It's very simple to say that that can be fixed. I don't think it can be fixed really quickly, but I think there can be more effort placed into better understanding the role the Commonwealth plays and aligning that with the role that the states and territories play, and hopefully putting a lot more effort into prevention and early intervention services, which is what all the reviews, and there's been hundreds of them, have suggested for many years now.
You have made the point that the resources tend to be at the crisis end of the problem, with not enough at the prevention end, but how difficult is it really to cover the field at the prevention end?
It is very difficult. It is, and I think partly because the system is skewed so much to the crisis end, it's expensive there. So I know from running an acute mental health unit, you've got to be able to fund it, staff it, have it available. But it would be a lot cheaper, a lot more efficient if people didn't end up in crisis in the hospital system. And to do that, you have to re-gear and change the system back towards community recovery, community services, and step-ups and step-down facilities, for example. And, of course, make sure that we're targeting particular groups. I mean, it's well understood that you know, young people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, people from different cultural black backgrounds are all particularly vulnerable groups, and, you know, targeting them and having solutions for those particular groups would also help.
We certainly hear a lot more these days about, for example, mental health problems among the young than we did perhaps a few years ago. Do you think this is because these problems have increased, or do you think it's because they're identified more or even spoken about more?
Well, I think the professional view, and I'm not a professional in this area, but would say that there is increasing prevalence of mental health problems within the younger population due to various factors. And they would say even for children under the age of 12, there are a lot more children with anxiety issues are being identified much younger than we'd previously seen. And so that's requiring the service system to say, well, how are we going to actually deal with these issues of children, you know, as young as 8 and 9 really presenting with considerable mental health problems? There's mixed views about what the cause of it is. The fact that, you know, the world moves very quickly, it's very uncertain, technology's changing a lot of things, exposing young people to different pressures and that perhaps weren't around when I was young, but I don't think there's a fixed view necessarily on what is the cause of it. But there is no doubt, I think the Mental Health Commission's report said that about 600,000 young Australians are experiencing mental health problems every year. It's a huge amount.
There's been a swing in recent years for older people against institutionalising people with problems or institutionalising them for as long. Do you think this has gone too far, that swing away from institutions, or do you think we've got the balance about right?
I think there's a lot of problems with closed institutions, without a doubt. And my experience has been with people with intellectual disabilities more than in the mental health arena, but many of the issues would be the same. There are still hundreds of mental health beds that are in institutions around the country now, every day, where people are locked up, sometimes indefinitely. We're a bit better about opening up those systems to have official visitors and some scrutiny. But I think, again, the general view of people who work in the sector would be they're not an ideal solution, but they might be a solution for some. Forensic mental health units, for example, are there for people who require that sort of care, but more emphasis should be placed on better housing solutions, again, not at that acute end, but trying to prevent people from getting there in the first place.
An overlapping but separate problem is that there does seem now to be quite an epidemic of ICE usage, which is causing all sorts of problems in the community. To what extent do you think this is putting pressure on mental health facilities, and how serious do you think it is, and what can be done about it?
Well, I think without a doubt for those communities that are affected by ICE, it's extremely disturbing situation. And I think the relationship between mental health and drug and alcohol and other drug, illicit drugs has been well established. You will find a close correlation between people who are using illicit drugs, using alcohol, and mental well-being or lack of mental well-being. So those links are very clear. The links then on to other things like homelessness are well established. And so, again, I think that puts a lot of pressure back on the mental health system to respond to these emerging trends and to try and deal with them, because at the end of the day, people are going to end up in the mental health system, with these terrible addictions, but primarily they'll have to be treated for their mental illness.
Is this much of a problem, ICE, in the ACT?
Look, I think, the ACT is like any other part of Australia. We like to think we're different, but I think if you talk to anyone, any law enforcement, emergency services, they'll tell you stories about ICE. It's perhaps not as prevalent as it has been in some communities across Australia, but I know that stories from the emergency department of people presenting in psychotic states, extremely violent, will be tied back to a use of ICE and other illicit drugs.
It seems very difficult, really, to know how to combat this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the jobs, and I note, there's ICE task forces in various forms around the country, is, again, to educate particularly young people about the harmful effects of using drugs like ICE.
Now, Labor's recently made the pledge that it will reduce suicide by 50% over 10 years if it's in government. Given the complexities of the suicide problem, this seems a really ambitious goal. How can you do this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, and the mental health sector has been pushing for a target to reduce suicides for some time now. I mean, 65,000 people attempt suicide every year in Australia. 2,500 of them are successful at completing suicide, and I think that shows you the extent of the problem. We fret and worry about safety on the roads. We don't fret and worry as much about those suicide statistics. We also know that for people with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander background are twice as likely to suicide than non-Indigenous Australians. So the statistics are all there. They don't tell a very good story. I think some of the responses are that we'd have to target particular populations. Again, the data tells us a story. The other is to have regional solutions, because some of the issues can be quite localised to particular populations, so a one fits all approach isn't going to work. And the other issue, I think, is for people leaving acute mental health units, making sure that discharge and community planning about their recovery is in place, because for many of those, they're a particularly vulnerable group prone to suicide.
Can we just turn to some wider topics? Only a few weeks ago, Labor looked to be a really pretty good bet to win the next election, to throw out a first-term government. But now, of course, with the change of Liberal leadership, it all looks different, and Labor's struggling not to seem behind the eight ball, not to seem to be old-fashioned. How do you think that the situation can be changed again to make Labor more competitive?
Well, I think we just have to keep doing what we've been doing. One thing I have learnt coming into the Senate is just how difficult it is for oppositions to get their message out. As this is coming when speaking from someone who was elected into government and has only experienced government, so I've certainly seen that. Politics changes all the time. That's one of the things that keeps us all interested in it. You know, you can be travelling one path and you think this is going to happen, and then all of a sudden, you know, exactly, you're operating in a different environment. So I think the best position would be to continue the work that's been done. I mean, Labor's put out 12 policies in the time that I've been in the Senate. That's, I think, quite unusual in that we'd have so many policies out this far out from an election. But we need to stay focused on our message and stay focused on the work that's been done to develop our policy, and, you know, continue to put those messages out. But I'm not going to pretend that, you know, the situation has changed. You know, Tony Abbott was a very unpopular Prime Minister, and Malcolm, his honeymoon is certainly lasting. So it's going to require Labor to fight hard from opposition, but, you know, at the same time, we can't get distracted from the job that was put in place, you know, 18 months ago.
Now, you mentioned those policies, and when you put it like that, that's quite a lot of policies. But beyond a couple about tax, they really don't get talked about a lot. And, for example, the policy put out at the weekend that you might take the voting age down as low as 16, and certainly that you take it down to 17, we haven't heard about that really since it was announced by Bill Shorten. Have you had any reaction on that policy?
Well, I have. I mean, actually, I've got an 18-year-old, so I was talking to her and a group of her friends, and, you know, they're very interested in ideas like this coming up. So, again, I think with those 12 policies, if you look at some of the ones around startups and getting more women involved in that, in the innovation area, the commitments in higher education, I think within those particular populations where stakeholders, those policies are being talked about and people are interested in them. But again, you know, from opposition, I think, you know, Bill, I think, probably visits a STEM or a startup or something at least once or twice a week. He's certainly at the universities once or twice a week talking about those policies. But I think it just goes to show you how hard being leader of the opposition actually is, when, you know, you've got to continue to front up every day and keep repeating your message in order for just a part of it to get through.
That policy, incidentally, about the younger voting age does seem to have come under a bit of criticism, and mm-hmm. people have been sceptical about it. Do you think that, on balance, people as young as that are really caring, are really wanting a vote?
Well, I think it'll differ. You know, children or young people at that age have different interests. There'll be some that are incredibly interested in it, and perhaps I run into a few more of those in Canberra than you'd see in other places in Australia. And there'll be children, young people sort of moving into those age groups that aren't interested in it. So I don't think that's different to any other policy initiative, though, where you'll get mixed reaction. I think there's some strong arguments for it, and there'll always be arguments against it. You know, 16-year-olds do pay tax. you know, they are able to drive on our roads. We allow them to make certain decisions about their own welfare and participation, but, you know, this is an extension of that, you know.
On the other hand, you could say we do have a rather odd voting situation in the Senate, or odd results from the voting situation. If a 16-year-old ended up in the Senate as one of the balance of power senators, would you be comfortable with that?
I work with young people in politics all the time, not necessarily as elected representatives, but, you know, they're worthy contributors. You know, it's hard to try to imagine that scenario, but...
Well, we have Ricky Muir, who got hardly any votes, so it's not impossible if there weren't changes to the Senate voting system.
Yeah, that's right. No, I agree, it's not impossible. You know, I take part in forums with young Labor members. I mean, the ones that are interested in politics, I wouldn't discount them as people that couldn't participate in a parliamentary chamber.
Well, I think it's true to say that the voting age won't be one of the central issues at the coming election next year, but we do know that one big issue will be tax reform, and this is shaping up as possibly the government proposing an increase, and even a broadening, but certainly an increase in the GST. After the 2014 federal budget, you in fact urged an increase in the GST because of the squeeze on state and territory revenues. What's your view now on this?
Well, I think the GST has always been a revenue line that the states and territories rely heavily on, and the ACT is no different. So if the collection of GST, which has really been the issue since 2008, goes down, state and territory budgets suffer for it. I think coming into the Senate, being part of the federal Labor team, you do get a different perspective on, I guess, a whole range of areas where revenue is raised and how that can affect individual householders across the country.
And, of course, Labor federally is opposed to any change in the GST.
That's right. And I guess... I'm comfortable in the sense that we are having a talk about revenue now. I mean, for the last few years, it's been all about it's a spending problem. There's no revenue problem. We've just got to tighten our belt and that will fix everyone's budget. It now appears that there is acknowledgement that there's a revenue problem. Labor's position is that that revenue should come from other areas other than the GST, and particularly those areas where it's not going to affect low and middle income earners. But I think the acknowledgement that there is a revenue issue as well as looking for savings is welcome in terms of the whole tax reform debate.
So perhaps your movement on this issue is part of the movement from being in charge of the small team to being part of the new team, team.
Yeah, and also having the opportunity, you know, at that time, post the 2014 budget, there wasn't talk of a multinationals tax. There wasn't talk about changes to superannuation. You know, there wasn't discussion about some of the, you know, savings that could be looked at in the housing sector. None of that was being talked about. I mean, the states and territories, as receiver of revenue from the Commonwealth, rely heavily on the GST, and that pool was shrinking, and it places pressure on those budgets. So, you know, I have enormous sympathy with the states and territories, particularly with how they have to fund the services that that budget, the 2014 budget, also walked away from. But if you get your federation discussion happening, you get people around the table on tax reform, you come up with ideas around revenue, then, you know, I think Australia will be better placed for it.
Katie Gallagher, it's been good talking with you today. Good luck with the new portfolio responsibilities, and we'll talk again in the future. That's all from the Conversations podcast for today. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and we'll be back with you soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.